Well, welcome to the IPC.
You're on.
Well, this is the 13th in our series of public lectures, which were actually started by one Jim Harlow, who is our speaker tonight. As you know, we try to bring some of the extraordinary scientists we have to the IPC and take part in our program and bring them into the community at large. And, but sometimes, once in a while, we make an exception and allow a local person to speak. And tonight, of course, our speaker, Jim Harlow, is very local. In fact, he's been more local than almost any one around. He's been a member of the physics department in Santa Barbara for over 25 years. Harder to really imagine for someone so young. He, in fact, is one of the famous Gang of Four who was established, conceived of, and established the IPC over 20 years ago. And he played a very important role in its conception and its development. And he, in fact, served as director of the IPC in the years preceding me. Jim is known for many things in physics, widely honored as a member of the National Academy of Science, fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and is famous for two things. One is his work in general relativity, and more recently, his work on the foundations of quantum mechanics. In general relativity, which is the subject of his talk today, he has a long collaboration with Stephen Hawking. And just to give you an idea of one of his important accomplishments, which I'm sure you did not refer to today, so I'll tell you that. He and Stephen Hawking were the first to give a real scientific idea as to what the initial conditions for the whole universe to be. So, why the universe is what it is requires some things to start it off. Harlow and Hawking made the first, I think, scientifically well conceived proposal for such a principle. Probably wrong, but it took a lot of guts. And in the history of science, I think, will be widely appreciated for its foresight. In recent years, he and his thesis advisor, Murray Gell-Mann, have been exploring the foundations of quantum mechanics, trying to make sense, for example, how do you discuss the wave function of the universe, and how do you discuss the interpretation of quantum mechanics when you only have one universe and you're not allowed to repeat experiments, unfortunately. In fact, Murray gave one of our public lectures, I think, 2 years ago, which he discussed his work with Jim. So, your public lecture at this time is that recently the National Academy of Sciences decided to do a 10-year decadal survey of gravity theory. The National Academy does this every 10 years in all important fields of science. But until now, gravity was not included. That doesn't mean it wasn't important. For the federal government, important means expensive. And for the first time, gravity has become an expensive field of science. So the government needs advice. And naturally, they turned to Jim and asked him to chair one of these prestigious panels that survey the whole field and tell the government how to spend billions of dollars. So Jim did the first of these decadal surveys and produced a wonderful little book summarizing the state and future and prospects of gravity from a theoretical point of view and, most importantly, from an experimental point of view. And So therefore, it's really appropriate to ask Jim, convince him to give us all a talk on the current and future state of Jim.
This is for amplification. Can you hear me in the back?
No.
This is for recording. No? How about now? Is that better?
No, it's not better.
Turn off.
Testing in the back? Better? I'll try to do the best I can.
Keep your chin down.
Well, thank you, David, for that introduction. I don't plan to talk about the wave function of the universe tonight, but rather, as David suggested, I want to talk to you about why gravity is expensive. There are four fundamental forces in physics. There is the strong force, which is what keeps protons and neutrons together in the nucleus. There is the weak force, which sometimes causes the nucleus to decay. There's the electromagnetic force, which is what keeps the electrons bound to the nucleus of an atom to make an atom, and what keeps solids, such as your chair, together. The fourth force is gravity. That's what keeps the Earth together, the Sun together, the solar system together, the galaxy together, and in a certain sense, the universe together. Now, of the four fundamental forces, gravity has been studied the longest, since the time of Newton and Galileo, at least. Yet gravitational physics is one of the most rapidly changing areas of science today. Gravity certainly is an immediate fact of everyday experience. That's the Earth trying to keep one of its minor satellites together. Yet it presents us with some of the deepest experimental and theoretical challenges in theoretical physics. The subject contains some of the most accurately tested principles in all of science, and yet one of its most basic predictions, the gravitational waves, they've never been conclusively received on Earth. Gravitational physics is certainly concerned with some of the most exotic phenomena in the universe, the Big Bang, black holes, pulsars, quasars, gravitational waves, the microscopic structure of space-time, sometimes called space-time foam, and the unification of all forces. Yet it's also concerned with the minute departures from the behavior of clocks and orbits in the solar system from the laws that were originally laid down by Newton. Departures, for example, nowadays are used every day in the operation of the global positioning system. In my talk, I want to give a sort of broad-based survey of gravitational physics to tell you where it's been recently and where it's headed. So first, a few key facts about gravity. Gravity is the weakest of the four fundamental forces. The gravitational force between two protons, right, the ratio of that to the electromagnetic force between two protons, is a very tiny number, 10 to the minus 40. That's 1 over 1 with 40 zeros after it. It's the weakest of all forces, but to compensate, it has a number of properties. It's a universal force. It couples through absolutely everything. Mass is gravitational charge in a way. So all forms of mass and energy will act gravitationally. Two clumps of mass, they will all attract according to Newton's law. Furthermore, it's long range. It acts at very great distances. The gravitational force only varies between the distance. It squares the distance between the body. And most importantly, it's unstable. There's no negative gravitational charge. That lack of screening means that in the contest to see which force is going to govern the universe on a very large scale, gravity inevitably emerges as the vector. You might say, well, look at the electromagnetic force. That's 10 to the 40th times larger But the universe is approximately electrically neutral. There are just as many protons as electrons in that table, for example, or in any other object you might encounter. Occasionally you get a little electrical effect by, you know, rubbing them off with a cloth or shuffling them on the carpet, but basically that makes the electromagnetic forces been canceled out because there are roughly equal amounts of gravitation of the electric charge of one side, electric charge of another. But in gravity, so if you look at the universe in the large, the electrical force doesn't operate. The other two forces, the strong and the weak forces, all operate only in tiny ranges on the scale of the nucleus. So it's gravity that is the only thing that's left that governs the structure of matter on the largest scales, and that's why gravitational physics is important in astrophysics and cosmology. I'll put these few key facts over here. The modern theory of gravity is general relativity, Einstein's great achievement in theoretical physics. Relativistic gravity, there are just a few key facts about it that I'd like you to know. First of all, it's a statement about geometry, the geometry of space and time, taken together as one unit called space-time. And the key fact is the presence of mass, Earth space-time, so the presence of the sun, for example, causes a slight space-time curvature in its vicinity. The second fact is that free mass, that is not being acted upon by any other forces, moves on the straightest possible path in that space-time. Now, curved space-time is somewhat difficult to model, especially in four dimensions, but it has a number of simple consequences. For example, if you could get out in the Earth's orbit and make a big triangle, say, with light rays around the sun, the familiar theorems in Euclidean geometry, like the sum of these three angles, adding up to 360 degrees, wouldn't be quite true. It add up to 359, 99999, and out in the 11th decimal place, it would be a small correction. The very quite slight curvature of space that's produced by the sun and also a little bit by the Earth. That's a very tiny effect for the solar system, but it's a big effect, this curvature of space-time, for other objects, neutron stars, black holes, the Big Bang, the universe, and gravitational waves. However, this idea that space-time is curved and that things move on past it, it produced a sort of change in 1915 from the usual view of what gravity is. What we inherited from Newton in 1687 is that the Earth travels around the Sun on the orbit it does because of gravity, certainly. But the view is that it travels on that orbit because it's pulled inward towards the Sun by the gravitational force that's exerted by the mass of the Sun on the Earth. In Einstein's theory, the Earth continues to travel around the Sun, approximately, although not exactly the same orbit, because it's following the straightest possible path in the curved space-time produced by the Sun. So it's slightly curved up the space-time, and the Earth moves on what it thinks is the straightest possible path, and that produces the orbit. So, for example, when I threw that tennis ball up, I don't know where it is now, up in the air. What? No, that's okay. We don't need to do demonstrations. It followed a curve, right, in space-time, which in a certain sense is the straightest possible path it could follow, right, between going back and coming back down. Now, you say, well, that sounds crazy. It doesn't look like it's the straightest possible path in. To me, it went up and it curved. But you have to do the calculation in space-time. And when you do it, right, you find it's following the straightest possible path in space and time. In a certain sense, if you move upward in this room, time, right, is moving at a more rapid rate higher up than it is down here on the ground. That change is what's responsible for the tennis ball turning over. Now, that might seem an exotic thing to many of you, but in fact, it's used every day, right, by many in the global positioning system. I'll remind you what the global positioning system is. It's a network of 24 satellites in various orbital planes around the Earth. And it works in the following way. there's a two-dimensional picture of how the GPS works through the satellite. One satellite is constantly broadcasting signals with the following two pieces of information. It broadcasts its own location, that's one thing, and it broadcasts the time it sent the signal, a little puff. You're down here with a GPS receiver, you receive the signal later. Since the signal contained the information of when it was sent, you can figure out how long it took. Well, the signal is a radio wave, which travels at the velocity of light. If you know how long it took, you know how far away it was. Multiply the velocity of light times the time. So you know you're somewhere on a sphere that's the radius, which is the velocity of light times that signal. Well, that maybe doesn't tell you exactly where you are, but if you take the information from another satellite, which sort of reduces it to two possible locations, if you take more satellites, you get the location uniquely. In fact, if you take enough, you don't even have to know what time it is. It tells you what the time is exactly. But in the operation of the global positioning system, relativistic effects are important. Actually, there are two relativistic effects that are important. There's first Einstein's effects of special relativity, which said if a clock is moving, it runs slow. That's called time dilation. And the clocks of the GPS are going to be moving around the Earth, so they run slow. But there's the other effect I mentioned just earlier, with the tennis ball, which is clocks higher up in the gravitational field run fast, right? Because of the slight curvature of space-time, right? And so neither of these effects is very big. They're only a few parts in 10 to minus 10, but they don't cancel. So the effects of relativity, the net effect, is that the clocks in the GPS satellites are running fast to compare to the clocks on the Earth. And if the GPS satellite didn't correct for that, it doesn't broadcast the exact time of the clock at its location, it corrects a little bit for the offset due to its altitude. If it didn't do that, the whole GPS would crash in about a half an hour. So every day you're testing the curvature of those of you who use the GPS, testing the curvature of space and time, depending on the year. Now, all those are interesting effects, and it's amazing that we can certainly detect them. It's also amazing that we can use them. Right? But more interesting for our gravitational physicists is, where is gravity important in the universe? It's important in two places. I mentioned how, for ordinary everyday life, gravity is not particularly important. It does good things like keeping the feet on the ground and so forth, but it's not important for the structure of materials, for example. Relativistic gravity is important on very large scales, the scales of astrophysics in the universe, and the relativistic part is most important for massive contact objects with a lot of mass and a small volume. This is the equation, right? This is Newton's gravitational constant times the mass divided by the size of the Earth. And the types of objects for which relativistic gravity is important, neutron stars, very compact stars that are at the last stages of the evolution of stars, black holes, universe, gravitational waves. That's the realm of strong gravity that I hope to talk to you a little bit about today. But remarkably, for contemporary physics, gravity is also important on another scale. I've mentioned how it's important for the largest scales considered in contemporary physics, but it's also important for the smallest scales. It's important when you try to quantize the gravitational field. The smallest scale is called the Planck scale after Planck, and it's the only combination of Newton's constant, Planck's constant, which governs quantum mechanics and the velocity of light. It's a very small number, 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. It's 1 over 1 with 33 zeros. To help out, I tried to write that out. That's the size of the proton, which is a very small number. 1 10,000 billion, right, of the size of a proton. Actually, my ability to convert between scientific notation and 10,000 billion billion is probably limited. But give or take a few billion or thousand, right, it's a very small number. Now, in particle physics, small size means high energy. And so there's a corresponding Planck energy, which is 10 centimeters, which is 10,000 billion times larger than the energies that can be achieved with the largest accelerator. Yet this is the scale that characterizes in contemporary physics the union of the two great achievements of 20th century physics, gravity, Einstein's general relativity, and quantum mechanics, and a unified theory of the forces, promising candidate for which is Springer. Great focus of this institute and of our director. These fails mean that we're, for subjects like this, 10,000 billion times larger than the energy team's largest accelerator, means we're not going to be doing this kind of physics directly, right, at those high energies. It would probably cost 10,000 billion times as much, right, which, physicists are used to making large-scale proposals today. Rather, if we look around the universe, you have to rely on gravity itself to produce the environment where you might reach those energies. There are only two places, in the Big Bang or the evaporation of dry fluids. The evaporation of black holes. How are you in the back? And
still coming through?
Gravity is less a two frontier science. It's important on both the very largest scales of contemporary physics, gravitational collapse, black holes, gravitational waves, relativism of stars, and the universe itself. The subject is astrophysics and cosmology, and it's important on the smallest scale of contemporary physics, quantum space-time, quantum gravity, elementary particle physics, and string theory. Now, I'd like to review a little bit the status. I mean, how do we know that Einstein's theory is correct? The classical tests in the solar system tell us a lot. There are a number of these classical tests, the gravitational redshift, the bending and time delay of light, the precession of the perihelion of the planet Mercury, all were important effects. But interestingly enough, over the last several decades, they've undergone a certain kind of evolution. Einstein put his theory out in 1915, and these were very tiny effects that were difficult to detect. By now, in the 70s, they've offered precision measurements to test them with an accuracy of 1%. And a little later on, they've developed into annoying corrections and other precision measurements where people were trying to measure different things. And finally, into new tools in astronomy and astrophysics. I'd just like to illustrate that evolution with one example, which is the bending of light by the sun. Einstein's theory tells us that gravity attracts light. Well, if you're looking at a star and its actual position is here, light will be bent around the sun, attracted by it, and so its apparent position will be shifted outward from its position, its actual position. So if you take a picture of a field of stars, right, when the sun is in the middle, and then take a picture 6 months later, you'll see a shift in the positions of the stars outward. That's how the bending of light is detected. And here's an example of early on detection. This is from Lick Observatory, Campbell and Crumpler, 1922. And you can see here they did just exactly that experiment. They made if you want to look at the effect is biggest when you're closest to the sun, when the attraction is strongest. So you want to look at stars close to the sun when the sun is in the field of view. Right? There's only one problem with that. The sun is bright in the day range. The stars are emitting in. So you can't see them. You can see them at the moment of a solar eclipse when the sun is sort of blocked out. The people waiting for solar eclipses to take place, often involving journeys to this intense. So you see a picture of the eclipse and this is the solar corona. And you can see their day. Here are the various shifts they discovered for the various stars in the field. You can see the data is sort of jumping. Some stars are moving inward, outward. It's a difficult experiment to do, but it gave first important confirmation of Einstein's theory. Here's the same experiment done in 1975, not with eclipses and with stars, but with quasars, which have been discovered since then. Quasars are strong emitters in radio wavelengths. The sun is not. So you can see quasars quite close to the sun, because the sun is not blocking out their light. So here's a particular example. This is the quasar 0116.08, which every April 10th, it looks like, is occulted by the sun. The sun moves in front of it. So you measure the angle between that quasar and other quasars far away, which serve as a reference, right? And here's what you get down on the bottom slide. here is the deflection as a function of time. I don't know if there's, there's another picture like the one above that. A happy sun coming in, and I see an unhappy sun coming in. So now, let us figure out why entering should be happy. But anyway, it's just going over this 0116, and there are the data points, and there the solid curve is the prediction of general relativity. That the agreement with general relativity is usually measured by a number of gamma, which would be exactly one. Pretty good test for 1% accuracy. Right from there. Well, any object will bend by a little bit, even you, but the effect is very small. The effect for the sun, which is the largest object around, right at the limb is 1.575 seconds of arc. Just a little bit. I mentioned that these experiments that undergone a sort of evolution. Small effect difficult to detect precision measurement and annoying corrections and other precision measurements. This is data from Marshall Eubanks and his collaborators at the Naval Observatory. They're not interested in measuring, measuring the reflection of light, but that wasn't their prime purpose. They wanted to study the rotation of the Earth. Study the rotation of the Earth, right? You need a reference frame. What better reference frame than the distant quasars? So they tracked the angular positions of distant quasars over a very long period of time, from 1979 to 1996, making 1,550,000 observations of quasar position. The only trouble was, whenever the quasar got close to the sun, they had to correct for this annoying effect of general relativity. So here's Marshall Eubanks' data, right? These are, well, the data is pinned in these things, but that's the data, and this is the curve predicted by relativity. The interesting thing is that now you can see the bending of light by the sun, not just in the vicinity of the sun, but behind your head. The whole star sheet field shifts outward, right? And you can see it all the way back to nearly 180 degrees. So that's an annoying correction. And here is the bending of light being used as a tool. This is a picture of a gravitational lens. A gravitational lens is sort of like an ordinary lens, except through gravity. In the middle here, you can see a big collection of galaxies right in a little cluster. But behind that, more or less directly, very much further away, is a quasar. The light from the quasar gets bent around the around this mass by the simple process of bending of light. And here you see the images of the quasar that are formed. There should be five of them, really an odd number, around what's called the Einstein ring. That's a gravitational lens, and that's important for astronomy because that bending of light that's exhibited by the lens can be used to weigh the galaxy, because how much the light is deflected depends on how much mass there is. And it doesn't necessarily, gravity is very democratic. It doesn't have to be visible light. It can be dark matter, right, for example. Unless you get it, it's used as a tool to measure dark matter. Well, what's next in, that's just one experiment, right, in the history of it. What's next in precision measurement? There are a lot of next steps, right, and I could go into several of them. But one that's really of great importance concerns the principle of equivalence. I mentioned that in Einstein's general relativity, objects fall along move that are otherwise free of forces, move along curves that are determined by the spacetime itself. Now, that means every object moves along the curve that's determined by the spacetime, no matter what its composition. Or translated into experimental terms, it means that if I were to drop these two objects, one of which is higher than the other, or throw them up with the same initial velocities into the air, they should hit the ground at exactly the same time, following exactly the same curve. That's because that's the principle of equivalence. Now, unfortunately for you, I'm not going to be able to do this experiment because the director discovered my props before the talk and quoted some obscure university regulation that said you were not to throw dumbbells up in the air. Particularly in my performance in the inter-program softball game that occurred at the ICP and was not worrying about my arm. Well, because, of course, the experiment can be done in vacuum, right, and sort of exactly in the same way to worry about the rotation of the ball. But there are much better experiments to test this than these. Interestingly enough, the most accurate test, right, this shows the leading Kalar Pisa, because that's where Galileo first did that. So if you drop a cannonball, a feather, and a cat, or anything else in a vacuum, right, they should accelerate the same acceleration. And the accuracy which that's known is probably the best tested number in physics, one part, 5 parts of 10 to the -13. Interestingly enough, the best evidence for that, while they're very good experiments on the ground, the best evidence for that is the fact comes from ground-based experiments, but from watching the moon all around the Earth. Now, how do you watch the moon fall around the Earth? We need to detect the position of the moon with great accuracy. And that's done by a device, by a program called Lunar Laser Imaging. 1969 and 1971, the Apollo astronauts left on the moon arrays of corner reflectors. Now, a corner reflector is just, if you think of a cube and take three faces meeting at a point, right, so they make a little corner like this, right? That's a corner reflector, and it just has the geometrical property that if you shine a ray of light into the corner reflector, it always bounces right out at you. That's the property of mirrors. That means any light that shines on this corner reflector, right, comes right back out. So here's the McDonald Observatory in Texas shining a very intense laser at the moon. The laser signal goes up, hits the corner reflector, bounces back down. By timing the difference between the when the signal is emitted, when it's detected, you can measure the distance to the moon to the accuracy of the sensor. That enables you to track it very precisely and study how it falls, getting that information about the principle of equivalence. It's an interesting experiment. They send out 10 to the 18, 10 to the 18 zeros after photons, 10 times per second. They get one photon back every few seconds. Experiment, but they've been doing it since 1974. The accuracy is getting better and better. This is an example of cheap gravity. This experiment, which keeps on going on, is so cheap it gets lost in the NASA budget, and therefore it's always in danger of being cut. Anyway, the next version of that will probably be done from space. The reason it's done from space is because, roughly speaking, the accuracy of such an experiment depends on how long things fall. Right? If you're here on the Earth, you don't fall away, but if you put a satellite up, right, which has two masses in it, it falls as long as it's going around and around. So you keep building up the accuracy. And this should drive the accuracy to which we know this, the equivalence of gravitational inertial mass, down to 10 to the minus, one part of 10 to the minus 18.
Steve back
here
this.
We're measuring the difference between two accelerations, so we don't have to worry about the speed. Now, what would a violation of the principle of equivalence mean? As I mentioned, it's central to a geometric theory of gravity like Einstein's, because particles have to move on curves that are property of space-time. There's only one curve with any particular initial conditions for motion. So the minute you detect a difference in the acceleration, it would signal either a breakdown in our notion of space and time or some new forces of which we don't know. Now, interestingly enough, in certain areas of physics, right, that's nowadays considered a real possibility. Here's just one set of articles from the Los Angeles Times last November 16th. Right? Space and time are obsolete. Right? This thing is space and time are doomed. So, so we live in a time when, should the principle of equivalence be violated, there are a whole group of people that wouldn't fall on their pens, right, for because it was wrong. It would be evidence of new physics, right, and possibly evidence of string theory. Of course, string theory doesn't give us a definite prediction for the violation, but if we did, you think that there would be a definite prediction. Okay, that's for solar system tests, very tiny effects in the solar system. But what we're really interested in the next decade is the strong gravitational effect. Place is not where the space-time curvature is. We can characterize it by very tiny numbers that I have to keep saying one with so many zeros after them, but where the curvature of space and time is significant. And those are areas I want to talk about, areas I want to talk about, are gravitational waves, black holes, and cosmology. Now, undoubtedly, the greatest opportunity for progress in gravitational physics is, lies at the frontier of larger scales from the advent of gravitational wave detectors in this next decade. Einstein's theory predicts that propagating ripples in space-time curvature that move with the speed of light, in other respects, are somewhat like electromagnetic waves. Here's a simulation of gravitational waves. This is the gravitational waves coming from two objects that are moving around each other. And this is a sort of simulation where the amplitude of the height of the plane that you would see so elementary is a measure of the space-time curvature. It gets bigger and bigger as the objects get closer and closer together. This is a wave that's propagating outward. And it's a prediction of Einstein's theory. Now, what the source of gravitational waves is mass in motion. If you shake your fist, you're emitting a gravitational wave, but not very much of it. But interestingly enough, the universe is not necessarily very dim in gravitational radiation. For example, if you take a rather short period binary star that people in that object going around each other, it emits just about as much energy in gravitational radiation as invisible light. So the universe is not especially dim in gravitational radiation, but it is very difficult to detect because once produced, very little is absorbed. And therefore, in particular, not absorbed in a detector. That's a consequence of this fact that gravity is the weakest of the four fundamental forces. And its coupling, ordinary matter, is small, and measured by the 10 to the minus 40. Therefore, you have to, even though a lot of gravitational radiation is produced, right? And the reason, of course, why a lot is produced is because mass is charged, and the charge is on screen, so two giant charges are going down each other. But the very fact that makes it so difficult to detect makes it extremely interesting. Because if little is absorbed, it means that gravitational radiation, you could see further, right, than almost any other medium. You could see, in principle, back to the earliest moments of the universe, not merely to 300,000 years after the Big Bang, which we can see on electromagnetic radiation, and you could potentially see through the junk that surrounds them, right to the surface of black holes in gravity waves. Gravitational radiation has been detected. It's been detected not directly on the Earth, but indirectly from looking at the behavior of an object called a binary pulsar. That's two neutron stars going around each other. One of the neutron stars is spinning, right? And it has a radio beam that, as it spins around, it keeps spinning like this. And every as it crosses over us, we detect it. It's a pulse of radiation inside the pulsar. So a very big rotating object like that makes an extraordinarily accurate clock. And so you can detect a lot of things about that system by measuring the clock. In particular, you can get a very good information about the orbital period of the two pulsars around each other. They're emitting gravitational radiation, so they're slowly decaying because they're losing energy. And this is the change in the period, right, as measured by Joe Taylor at Princeton from 1975. Here, these are data points. That solid line is the prediction of general relativity. It agrees with this data to a third of a percent. I know it's a third of a percent because I put a half a percent in this document David referred to when I got a letter from Joe. So. That's a third of a percent. Pardon? Periastron. A periastron is like the perihelion. It's the closest approach of the stars. And so just a statement about there, not about the orbit. So I think any reasonable would say, person would say that gravitational waves have been observed, but they've never been detected on Earth. In that situation, what do you need to sort of detect gravitational waves? Well, you can think of gravitational waves sort of like a ripple on the ocean if you've got two quarks floating on it, right? As the wave goes by, you measure the distance between them, you get information about the properties of the wave. Similarly, if you have two test masses, or even just two or three test masses, and a gravitational wave goes by, they'll get closer or further away, depending on how strong the wave is. That's how you hope to detect it. Of course, we don't do it with quarks. The idea is to do it with what are called laser interferometers. A laser interferometer is just a big system like this. It consists of two mirrors here and a beam splitter. So a laser source sends light in like this. Half of it goes to this mirror, half of it comes back. The other half goes up to this mirror and is reflected back. They're then combined into detectors. Okay. Now, suppose, as you know, light can interfere. So suppose these waves are exactly the same distance apart. And we get constructive interference and see a bright spot. Suppose a gravity wave comes by, and this mirror moves, so it was beam splitted by some fraction of a wavelength of light, you could get destructive interference. So you could see that. Unless you can measure big interferometers, you can measure length, right, differential length, very accurately. Right? And in this case, you can measure them to a fraction of the size of the nucleus of an atom. We rely, right, on the gravitational waves hitting us from Earth. We don't aim it. It's too big, right? But if the Earth rotates and moves around in its orbit, we do get a certain amount of aiming. There's a worldwide network of gravity wave detectors of this kind now being constructed. Here is the U.S. effort. This is the LIGO gravitational wave detector. This is an actual aerial photograph of its conception. And here you see 2 to 4 kilometer long arms going out. It will have the mirrors at the end, and the end station will have the beam splitter. There's a comparable device in Livingston, Louisiana. If you don't want to know why they're there, you should ask who were the powerful senators at the time the appropriation was made. Most of the expense, which is considerable, $300 million, right, is in constructing these concrete shields for the tubes, because people are worried that hunters will come along these lasers and fire at them. Detectors like the LIGO detector are sensitive to the frequencies that are associated with explosive events. Superclass of a supernova, for example, the death throes of some massive star. Or take 2 neutron stars, for example, follow the binary pulsar much further in its evolution, and eventually those 2 stars will spiral in because they're losing gravitational radiation and coalesce. So such events, you expect to get a lot of gravitational radiation. But to cover, for example, the radiation coming just from 2 binary stars that I discussed in the beginning, we need to have much lower frequencies. The frequencies, for example, LIGO is roughly 1,000 hertz, with the binary stars in sub-hertz frequency. You can't do that, it's believed, on the surface of the Earth. Why? Because the surface of the Earth itself is signaling the same frequency, seismic activity. So you have to go to space. So here's the next step. This is a project called LISA, which is the same type of experiment. They have one more for redundancy done in space. Now, I want you to notice that is the Earth over here and there is the Sun. So this object is far out in space and it doesn't have the square kilometer arm. It would have 5 million kilometer arms. Unless it would be sensitive to these very low frequencies. It would be oriented like this in the Earth's orbit. And where is the Sun? It would say, here. That's a project that might conceivably be started next in late in the second. Now, the components of it tend to sort of make me believe that they can just buy the components in Radio Shack, right? But anyway, it's regarded by many as quite a feasible project. And just to reinforce what David said, this is why gravity is getting its sense. The subject. a detector, we might see objects like this. This is a picture of two galaxies in the optical and in the radio. And it's clear to everybody, I think, that they're interacting. They're close, and they're going to coalesce. And at the center of these galaxies, there probably are massive black holes, which I'll discuss in a minute. And if merging black holes emit a fraction, not just of some sort of binding energy, but of their rest mass, in a time that's characterized by their rest mass. So this kind of event would be the most energetic possible event in the universe. Right? It would have the maximum possible physical luminosity, which is roughly 10. Oh, I was going to convert that to kilowatts, which is 10 to the 52 kilowatts. Right? Energy, not just on usually gamma ray bursts, which is 10 orders of magnitude less. This would be as bright as the full moon, if you could see it, in gravitational waves. There's growing evidence that all galaxies that are sufficiently massive contain a black hole in the nucleus. If you extrapolate out to the beginning of the universe, to the edge of the universe, as you can see, you should expect those such events roughly once every month. That would be a very interesting thing to see. So gravitational waves are a new window on the universe, the first in quite some time. I'd now like to turn to black holes. One of Einstein's theory's most famous predictions of a black hole, if you compress mass into a small enough volume, right, the spatial curvature, or if you like, the gravitational force can be so strong that nothing gets out. Heaven, not even light. At least possible. So, relatively today, black holes, whenever a gravitational collapse proceeds sufficiently far, whenever it squashes down to a very small volume. Now, although the gravitational collapse that forms them is often quite messy, general relativity also predicts that black holes are just characters, at least the astrophysical ones, are characterized by these two numbers, their total mass and their total angular momentum. That's theoretical heaven. You've got very complicated phenomena to explain with just two numbers. Everything else has got to line up if the theory is correct. So you could test Einstein's theory, you could get at the details of this gravitational collapse. Now, gravitational collapse occurs in a lot of places in the universe because almost every astrophysical phenomenon is a tension between the attractive forces of gravity and other forces that are trying to hold things apart. The sun, for example, is a balance between gravity, which is trying to pull it all to the center, right, and the pressure of hot gas, which is heated by thermonuclear burning in its interior. Well, if the star was massive enough, eventually it would run out of fuel, and some of those would make black holes. For the sun, it'll probably settle down to another state called the white dwarf. But many places in the universe, you can expect to see black holes, and you do see. How do you detect a black hole? Well, from an astronomical point of view, as I just indicated, I mean, the simplest evidence is a lot of mass and a very small volume. Small volumes you can see. How do you measure the mass? Well, you measure it in the same way we measure the mass of the sun. How do we know the mass of the sun? We don't put it on the scale and balance it against the way we do it is from gravity itself. The mass of the sun can be determined from the speed of the orbit of the Earth and the size of the orbit. So, for example, the sun was four times more massive, the Earth would go around the year would only be 6 months long. So by figuring out doing experiments on Earth to know a little bit about gravity, you can weigh the mass of the sun and find out how heavy it is. Well, that's generally how you detect mass. Here's, for example, the evidence that there's a black hole in the center of our galaxy. These are very delicate observations in the infrared by Andrea Ghez and her co-workers at UCLA, and very clever imaging techniques, which I won't go into here. What you see here is a picture of the center of the galaxy. The center is the star here, the radio source Sagittarius of the star, right? And here you see some stars, positions of stars at successive years, 1995, 1996, and so forth. And I think you can see that the stars are moving around the center. By measuring the motions of the stars very carefully, you see, several years in the position, you find out that there's a very large mass contained in there, which is a million solar mass. So we believe there's a black hole at the center of that galaxy. Actually, this black hole is rather puny by the scale of the black holes that exist in other galaxies. It's a little unclear why many galaxies have billion solar mass black holes at their center. I don't know. We only have a million solar mass black hole at the center of ours, but it's our black hole, and we have to, we have to appreciate it and make it. But black holes are responsible for some of the most energetic phenomena in the universe. Here's there's a picture of one active galactic nucleus. These are objects which are turning the universe to be 100 to 10,000 times brighter than all the stars, for example, in our galaxy. And here's an example. Here's the radio source Sigma A. I'm not sure how well you can see this in the back. See this little dot in the center? That's the center of the galaxy. I put a little picture of Andromeda, which is not the galaxy, for you to judge the size of these things. They're enormous, much bigger than galaxies. And you see little tiny jets going out here, which you see in the radio. These jets are presumably particles, other forms of energy, are presumably being stopped by the interstellar medium producing huge loads. The total thing is giving out an enormous amount of power, perhaps as much as 10,000 times the size of the galaxy, of an ordinary galaxy. How does such a thing work? Well, it's just the principle of an ordinary electric generator transistor. So that's in there, that's the Best Buy model. Many of you, especially if you're in engineering, would know that if you make a generator by taking a conductor, like this yellow bit here, hooking it up with two wires, and another contact back here, and putting the whole thing in a magnetic field, and turning the crank. When you do that, current flows, power is delivered to the load. Now, black holes tend to behave somewhat like conductors. A black hole can carry current, for example. If you drop positive charges into one side of the black hole and negative charges into the other, it's effectively carrying a current. Going positive and going around and around like this. Black holes can also dissipate electromagnetic energy, like any conductor is, which it has resistance, because black holes can electromagnetic radiation can fall into the black hole, but it can't get out again, and therefore it vanishes, so it dissipates energy. In a more simple effect, from the point of view of a distant observer, any charge that falls into the black hole would never cross its horizon, because if it did, the light couldn't get out and you wouldn't have seen it. So from your point of view, it has to stick on the surface. That's also not charges on the surface of the conductor. The black holes actually behave somewhat like a conductor. And they have a surface mutativity, which is the space, if you don't get that, 366 on. So in principle, you should be able to make a black hole generator. Take a black hole, spin it around, put it in a magnetic field, hook it up with wires, right, and you get power out. Okay. The only problem with this, of course, is how do you hook up the wires and where do you get the magnetic field? Well, it turns out that astrophysical situations provide those quite naturally. There's the mechanism due to Blanchard and Klein. Black hole at the center of galaxy, some stuff is falling in on it. The stuff doesn't fall directly in anymore than we fall directly into the sun because of our orbital motion about it. It makes a disk. A material that goes around the black hole that's circulating constantly. That disk is fairly reasonably conducting in part, and it carries with it any magnetic field that it has lying around. And some of the magnetic fields that things that do fall in might actually have magnetic fields that spread the black hole. So that's how the black hole gets a magnetic field. How about the wires? Now, this is a more complicated story, but let me run through it anyway. If the conductor is rotating, there will, in addition to the magnetic field, be an electric field. The electric field is so strong that it causes the breakdown of the vacuum, and you get positive and negative positrons and electrons being created. Those are conducting. Right? So you get a conducting positive formula with black holes. Right? That's the wire. That's how the structure happens. But if you get big jets of energy going this way and that way, and output power, they just convert this into kilowatts. It's 10 to the 35 kilowatts. It's 1 in 35 zeros after slightly more, right, than 100 billion stars in the galaxy. So that's presumably how the black hole forms the most energetic objects in the universe. Well, that's today. What about the future? The future, in one sense, it's a great triumph of general relativity that we've seen black holes. But we've seen them as very massive objects in a very small body. That's about the extent of it, and they fit other things as well. But Einstein's theory, as I mentioned, makes very detailed predictions for black holes. There are only two numbers that fit all the astronomical data that are directly connected with it. In the future, we'd like to check the detailed predictions of Einstein's theory for the geometry around black holes. And that can be done by observation in the X-ray, which our chancellor here is carrying out, and again, in gravitational waves. For example, if you had two black holes spiraling in towards each other, you get gravitational waves, and they coalesce, you get more gravitational waves, and finally, if they sort of just settle down and oscillating, you get another type of gravitational wave coming out. A very detailed prediction for such a signal, not for these supercomputers to simulate. But in principle, it's known, and we could check all the details of Einstein's theory in that model. My final subject is cosmology. Einstein's theory predicts the expansion of the universe from an initial Big Bang. The Big Bang in modern science is not an issue, I think, anymore. We see the light from the Big Bang and the radiation that was emitted shortly after it started. Probably you've seen this picture before. This is a picture of the radiation from the Fogo satellite after a few effects have been subtracted out. Our own cosmic background radiation group here at UCSB participated in this experiment, another ongoing experiment. What are you looking at here? Well, the matter in the universe, when the universe was condensed, it was hot. Compressed something, it was stuck. Effectively, run everything backwards. If it was hot, it was emitting radiation. But in the very beginning, the universe was opaque. This was opaque because it was very dense. But as it expands, it gets thinner and thinner, and eventually you reach a point about 300,000 years after the Big Bang, where it becomes transparent to most of the radiation, and that radiation has been streaming to us ever since for the next 15 billion years to be detected by this satellite, another ground-based experiment. This is a map in galactic coordinates, and the colors on the map reflect the temperatures of the radiation. And this big red band is interference from the galaxy. If you look out at the plane of the galaxy, there's a lot of other junk, which is hot. But you can see the fluctuations in the microwave background, which are very important in cosmology, because while it does show that the early universe is a picture like this, certainly evidence that the early universe is very smooth, because the difference between the blue and the red here is only a few millions of degrees. Right? So it's not very much dynamic range. Right? These fluctuations are important because those little homogeneous grew by gravitational attraction to build galaxies, stars, planets. That's just the time when the universe becomes transparent. Right? It's getting thinner and thinner all the time, and so it's like a fog lift. Right? If the fog gets thinner, eventually you can see through it. Right? And so that's that just happens to be the time for the primary and larger universe. It's the whole sky. If we look out in every direction, you see this radiation coming through. If it's coming from the whole Big Bang, which is out there in any direction, it's there. Well, this is what shows what we'll be able to do with the mass satellites. We'll get much more detailed information about the Big Bang. There are lots of gravitational issues in cosmology. What's the geometry of the universe? We'd like to know, for example, how curved it is. We don't know. What's the source of the curvature? What kind of matter it contains? And even does the universe obey the basic law that Einstein predicted? All these are issues. Our knowledge is very limited in many ways because, for example, there's lots of evidence for matter of unseen kind, right, in the universe. I mentioned earlier how you could weigh the mass of the sun by watching stuff go around it, and how you could measure the mass of a black hole by watching stuff go around it. You can also measure the mass of a galaxy by watching stuff go around, by watching the material circulate around the galaxy. So here's a picture of our nearest neighbor, which is the Andromeda Galaxy, which is going to collide in a few billion years. Right? And what's measured here is the velocity of the material that's rotating around the center. How do they do that? Well, they look for the shifts in the spectral lines caused by that rotation. If the material is coming toward you, the spectral line from the material is slightly shifted to the blue. If it's going away from you, then it's slightly shifted to the red, and then it's going to shift, they can study the rotation. If the, all the matter were concentrated where you see it, right, the velocity of rotation should fall off, but less and less the further away you go. Just like the buds of the planet and solar system. But the radio observation by this graph by Lord Robertson doesn't show it falling off at all. So there must be an enormous amount of matter outside, probably 10 times as much as the mass of the galaxy, which is unseen or dark. We don't know exactly what it is. The current best data on the contents of the universe is 70% approximately in vacuum energy, that is energy of absolutely nothing, right? Of unknown origin, unknown reason, even in string theory, it's unknown. 30% of it is in particles of some kind, maybe they're black holes, maybe it's weakly interacting massive particles, we don't know what it is. 1% of it is in familiar particles like making up you and me. And the galaxies as well as the Earth. So on a scale of 1 to 100, we're not doing too well as far as that's right. It's a big unknown question. Lots of work being done trying to figure it out. Makes you wonder why you don't add up. Is it astronomy? Maybe more importantly, and this is what David alluded to in the beginning, cosmology is the place where the large and the small intersect, where the big and the small is the same. Because at the Big Bang, you get the highest energies, the particle physics, the string theory, and that's when the whole system was as small, which eventually became everything you can see, is as small as you can get. So at the Big Bang, those Planck energies I mentioned in the beginning are actually reached. And quantum gravity is important. Fluctuations in the structure of space-time are occurring. And that's the conjectured scale of the unification of all three. The Big Bang is the closest we are to seeing the quantum initial condition of the universe, which Dave mentioned. It's the place where the large and small are unified. Well, my hope is that this very brief treatment of where relativity is today and where it's going has indicated some of the changes in the field. It might be appropriate to conclude with Einstein. Now, Paul Fleming, he said, a theory is more impressive the greater the simplicity of its premises, the more different kinds of things it relates, and the more extended the area of its applicability. I hope you agree after listening to this talk, that that's no more than at his own great triumph, general relativity, at both the far-flung frontiers of the very large and the very small. Thank you. Any questions about the universe? You know? Oh, it's negligible. I mean, as far as, for example, a contribution is at 70%, or 1%, it's negligible even on that scale. The same is true with the microwave background.
Can you repeat the question?
I'll repeat the question. He wanted to know, I said the universe is quite luminous in gravitational waves. How much does that contribute to the energy density of the universe? The answer is, today, almost nothing. Right? The same is true for all the electromagnetic radiation from the stars and in the microwave background itself. And the reason is that because as the universe expands, a gas of photons of gravity, right, has a pressure. The pressure does work in the expansion of the universe, and it cools faster than the matter. So today, it's negligible. Back in the beginning, it was comparable. A graviton is to gravity, like a photon is to electromagnetism. It's a quantum, right, of gravitational field. No, the nice thing about gravity is it's long range, so it doesn't have a fixed scale like so many meters. It goes down like 1 over the... Newton's law says gravity is inversely proportional to the square of the distance between us. And that means it gets smaller as it goes to longer range, but it doesn't cut off, say, after 50 parsecs.
Is zero?
Infinitely far away, it's zero. But any finite distance is not zero. It attenuates, all right. Otherwise, we would, for example, be able to get off the surface of the Earth and to the Moon. So it gets weaker. Once we can get out, we can keep on going. But it does so not. It's not like some forces, which essentially, at a certain range, they stop. After 10 to, for example, the nuclear force, after 10 to the minus 13 centimeters, it's really essentially zero.
But you mentioned the evaporation of black holes.
Well, I said that nothing ever gets out of a black hole. That's too classic. But in quantum mechanics, you're probably possibly familiar with the unusual things can happen with certain probability. So even though, for example, classically, I am supported firmly here on the surface of the Earth, quantum mechanically, there's a certain probability that I'll tunnel through to the other side and wind up in wherever it is, India. Very tiny number. We don't have to worry about it. For a black hole, it's possible that stuff can tunnel out from the outside at a very low rate. We don't have to worry about that in astronomy either, right? Because the rate at which, if for example, a black hole is losing energy, a big black hole like a solar mass is losing energy by the quantum mechanical effect, is smaller than the rate at which it's absorbing energy from the 3-degree black body radiation, both completely negligible. But for tiny mass black holes, the measure forming the beginning of the universe, it might be an effect. And third parties would be off the Stockholm one day if they ever occur, if they ever sort of detected.
Would you care to offer a comment
on the sensitivity of the LIGO? Oh, a ringer in the audience. He wants to know if the sensitivity of LIGO will be sufficient that it will actually detect them. Of course, we've never seen gravitational radiation on the surface of the Earth, so it's somewhat of a guessing game, right, how much the sources are. But we believe we understand at least the basic mechanism, and so we can have some predictions. So the committee to which David referred re-examined the question of LIGO event rate. And it found for the basic event rate, which is neutron star interaction, the coalescence where they spiral down into each other, we predict that they should see nothing in the first phase of their operation, which was in 2002. The sensitivity is not enough. Okay. They believe with what they call reasonable upgrades, that is sort of the technology they understand, they can upgrade it in what they call the mid-day decade upgrade to a greater sensitivity, in which they should see events like that about once a year. But there are lots of sources in the universe, potential sources in the universe, some of them analyzed by people in the Institute, for example, whose statistics you don't understand. Enough to give a definite prediction of the rate, but which could potentially produce gravitational radiation that we'll see. We just don't understand how many of the objects there are in the universe to get away with so many events. If that happens, there could be many interesting surprises. You have to look, as I mentioned, there's no doubt, that I think, in a reasonable person, that gravitational waves exist. Joe Taylor has seen them. It's just going to be, but they're very hard to detect. You have to do it as a long-term project to do it. So it may take the entirety of a decade to do it.
When you say, can you speculate on the probability that the something that disturbs the Earth's orbit around the sun would extend off into the universe?
The question was, would I speculate on the probability that something would disturb the Earth's orbit around the sun, and we take off sailing about the universe? I hope the probability is small. It's difficult to hear. You're asking for the probability of a collision of the Earth, or a nearby path with something that might come large, that might come from outside the solar system. Right? It has to be large to take it out like that. The Earth is very close to the sun. It's very heavily bound. It'd be difficult to, as NASA knows, to get those rockets out of the solar system, they have to be firing all the time. You need some very massive object. We've never seen anything remotely like that in the entire history of the solar system, as far as I know. So you have to estimate the power of these systems, random estimate. You could go on another 5 billion years without seeing. But I really don't know.
It's an old joke, putting things in the space costs astronomical numbers, far more than the costs estimated even for LISA.
Well, I certainly haven't calculated these myself. I can only tell you what the proponents of the project say. First of all, these projects, both SET and LISA, are projects that would be shared in the near future. That's going to be a general trend in science, I believe. Those experiments get so big, it should be a worldwide effort and not simply a US effort. And these are on their way in that way. So the commonly bandied about figure is 200 million for the US share, which is large, but not, for example, as large as LIGO. But, there's a lot of it. But, it has to be looked at very carefully. Ballpark.
I think the hardest thing for me to understand that you've talked about is that the trajectory of a ball in a room, like if you threw, it's following the shortest path. Were you saying that because when it's higher, it's traveling faster, that small speed difference makes a time difference that results in such a dramatic...
It's not the shortest path in space, and it's in space-time. But let me put it in a different way. Right? Suppose the ball carried a clock. Right? If it carried a clock, then that clock is itself measuring a distance, a time in space-time. Its own curve. I explained to you just a little bit how clocks higher up in a gravitational field run faster. So it's actually advantageous to the ball to go up because it can take advantage of that faster time. But it doesn't want to go too far, it'll take a long time to get it. But a compromise between those two turns out exactly to be the trajectory of the ball when you get it. I agree, it's not a very easy principle to see, that's because we're not used to thinking in four-dimensional terms, in terms of space-time, and it has unusual properties, but I think that's the best way to do it.
Well, gravity waves are a perturbation in four-dimensional space-time, what's the medium of transmission of the gravitational waves? Is it that same four-dimensional space-time?
I would say something's wrong with the gravity wave is four-dimensional space-time, rippled up, and that ripple is propagating through it. But you could call that a medium if you wish, but that suggests something else inside. It is four-dimensional space-time, propagating ripples in space-time. Propagating ripples. I mean, but for electromagnetic waves, you could say, what is the medium? The electromagnetic medium is propagating.
If you saw a deviation,
all theories in physics have got some sort of limited to their validity. If we saw a violation of the principle of equivalence down to an accuracy of acceleration differed by a part in the 10 to the 18, Einstein theory would be still good on a very large, large enough scale. So it would predict gravitational waves, but the phenomenon on very tiny scales would have to be changed. So the big predictions about gravitational waves would be unchanged. Whoops, good man.
There's some controversy about the science of space. I'm very curious about how the LIGO system, if you have two lasers looking black holes that coalesce, and it puts out a waveform, some of which is predicted by some of the geometry models, if in that last mystery, it could reduce the mass of the lasers, and at the same time, it was apparently mass two units.
There are effects in gravitational waves through which you can get information like that. But the very fact you have to determine the masses, right, in addition, and that's a very detailed information to get that. And we expect to settle the question of whether space, in the cosmological sense, is curved up like this, flat, or curved the other way, much before these experiments even reach that level of sensitivity through microwave background experiments occur in, like I mentioned, in connection with Cobe satellite. But your question is important because all the story of cosmology assumes that Einstein's theory is correct. Exactly. In the attempt to determine a few parameters about the theory. Really, you should be checking that, including check the predictions that you're mentioning. But I think that's for the 22nd century. When an astronomer or an astrophysicist talks about the universe, they mean everything we've got. So sort of by definition, there's only one. People sometimes mean different things by different universities, like maybe you can branch off or something. That can't happen in classical general relativity. Or sometimes they just mean a place that's very far away. We're not in communication with, and that will not be in communication with for a long time. Sometimes that's called a bit meaningless. But in the sense I'm using it, I mean by definition it's the whole thing. I would count that as part of our universe, because maybe if we wait long enough we will see. You see, what we can see in the universe depends on our time in the Big Bang. Because as we look out, we also look backward in time. Backward in time, we've only got 15 billion years since the Big Bang, or roughly speaking, we've only seen 15 billion years out. But the older we get, right, the further we see, because the more time we lose since the Big Bang. Certainly it doesn't. For you and I, it doesn't get very fast. I actually have my relativity card. Of course, I think that space-time is on large scales, that it's fundamental. And I tried to convince you in this talk of the many different things that explain. Down some precision tests, for example, the GPS that you're talking about, which is explained by the curvature of space-time, all the way up to the power emitted by black holes and to the evolution of the universe as a whole, as far as you can see it. That's an immense range of phenomena, right, that is covered experimentally by one basic theory, which is the space time. I don't know, as far as I know, there is no competitor that will explain that complete range of phenomena. The theory has been looked at in the solar system in great detail, more experiments than I could cite, and it survived after all the time, it survived a century and a half.
and open contact with
you. Yes, it comes down.
There's been some speculation that very large distances, the gravitational attraction sort of reverses in a very weak sense in order to explain certain expansion characteristics of the universe. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, I mentioned
it. Debunked?
No, it's in fact, it's the story of the okay, I'm not going to find it. Right, I have that 70%, 30%, 1%. That 70% of vacuum energy is on cosmology is effectively repulsive because the universe to expand more rapidly than gravity. If I threw my tennis ball up again, right, it's attracted down and it decelerates. The effect of this vacuum energy would actually do is accelerate the energy away from each other. And if we could do it with particles in very large scales, you would see the particles moving away faster and faster. Okay. So that 70% of the energy has the character that it would accelerate like that. I saw sometime I was listening to CNN, right, and they were reporting a confluence in which the quantum conference of which was announced for the first time. The data circle in the world. Sure. Advisory panel speaking. And at the same conference, there was also a lot of discussion of infrared observations of depth in the universe. So the commentator summed it up and said, well, I guess in this conference we could say that the universe is dirty and it's repulsive. So we couldn't see it, in the planet.
What are the elements of vacuum energy? Vortices of dark matter or just the radiation?
That's the problem. No one knows. Not even David.
Yeah, you mentioned the difficulties of focusing if you look for gravitational waves. How do you filter out the gravitational wave from a particular source out of the blend that comes into the experiment from everywhere?
The question was, the question how do you distinguish gravitational waves from other noise sources?
Yeah.
How do you do it? Telescope. Okay.
Yeah, how do you look for it?
The worldwide network of gravitational wave detectors doesn't have a lot of directional sensitivity because there are only a few of them. But it does give you some directional information. For example, if you see a pulse coming from, it arrives at Hanford, Washington at one time, a little bit later in Louisiana, right, then it's coming from that region of the sky, half a region of the sky, that's above the plane that intersects Livingston and Hanford. Take more, if you have a sufficiently massive event, there may be a dozen such detectors that would refine it. But astronomers don't exactly hope to do to find out what is the source by that way. A preferable method would be to look in other wavelength bands, in the optical, for example, and look for an exploding that happened exactly at the same time in the field of the optical. Then you would know exactly what it is. So, you know,
I think we should.